KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Robert Francis Prevost is the first American Pope, and in his first words as Leo XIV, he said the Catholic Church must build bridges. How might he lead? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, we meet a priest who studied with Pope Leo and then worked with him in Peru. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldil. Also, the Department of Transportation has a plan to upgrade old air traffic technology. How much will it cost? President Trump appoints Fox News host Jeanine Pirro to be the interim federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C. It's Friday, May 9th. On this day in 1754, the Pennsylvania Gazette published the first American political cartoon, a divided snake critiquing disunity among the colonies. The caption, "Join or Die." The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court says former Justice David Souter has died at his home in New Hampshire. He was 85. Souter was nominated to the High Court in 1990 by former President George H.W. Bush. He served until 2009. Souter had strong Republican support, but surprised many by voting with liberal justices during much of his tenure. Trade negotiators from the U.S. and China are starting talks this weekend in Switzerland. These are the first high-level, face-to-face trade talks between the two countries since President Trump returned to the White House. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
The talks come despite pretty consistent defiance from China, which said it would, quote, fight to the end as levies on its goods climbed over the last few weeks. China has also demanded, quote, sincerity before this weekend's talks kick off, and for new U.S. levies to first be lowered, something President Trump has refused to do. Analysts say China also wants the U.S. to roll back export controls on AI-related technology like semiconductor chips. The U.S., meanwhile, has not yet laid out what concessions it would like to see from China. A Phase 1 trade deal during Trump's first term required China to buy more American goods, which China largely ended up not doing. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge in San Francisco will hear arguments today in a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's sweeping overhaul of the federal government. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, the case was brought by a coalition of unions, nonprofits, and local governments.
The case is the broadest legal challenge yet to President Trump's efforts to dramatically downsize the government. The plaintiffs contend that Congress has the sole authority to undertake the kind of wholesale transformation Trump has ordered, shutting down programs and firing large swaths of the workforce. They argue actions taken by Trump, Elon Musk, and the heads of nearly two dozen federal agencies usurp Congress's authority under the Constitution. They're asking the court to void agencies' plans for mass layoffs, as well as Trump's executive order directing agencies to come up with those plans. Trump has repeatedly said that he has a mandate from the American people to root out waste and bloat and make government more efficient. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Pope Leo XIV celebrated the first mass of his papacy today in the Vatican's Sistine Chapel. Robert Prevost is the first ever American pope, born in Chicago. He is the youngest of three brothers. The pope's older brother, John Prevost, says his younger brother cares deeply for the poor because of the type of person that he is.
A regular, run-of-the-mill person, I think because he was trained in missionary work in South America for so many years, he will be looking out for the disenfranchised. He will be looking out for the poor.
The Vatican says that Leo will be formally installed as Pope during a Mass on Sunday, May 18th. On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 70 points. This is NPR. The U.S. Postal Service Board of Governors has named new Postmaster General. It's David Steiner, the former CEO of Waste Management, an environmental and waste management corporation. Steiner has also served on the board of directors for FedEx. A Russian spacecraft launched 53 years ago could come crashing down as soon as tonight, but exactly where on Earth it will land remains unclear. NPR's Amy Held reports people are on alert for what may be an unusual re-entry.
Since 1972's failed launch to Venus, the craft has been orbiting Earth, slowly sinking. It's expected to finally fall this weekend. It's not unusual for space junk to enter the atmosphere. Often it just burns up. This time could be different. Cosmos 482 was built to sustain landing on the second planet from the sun, Venus. So it's possible the 1,000-pound craft with a titanium shell will withstand the heat, pressure, and speed of entry to Earth. Experts say the vast possible landing area is mostly ocean or uninhabited land, but not all of it. And because it's an uncontrolled entry, the risk is also not zero. Space agencies are monitoring it. Amy Held, NPR News.
Transportation officials in the San Francisco Bay region say the area's rail transit system is entirely suspended. Officials with the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, or BART, say a computer networking system problem has forced all trains to shut down. Many commuters in the wider San Francisco area are stranded. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
On a Friday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. The first American pope in history celebrated his first Mass as pontiff today.
You have called me to carry that cross and to be blessed with that mission. And I know I can rely on each and every one of you to walk with me as we continue as a church, as a community of friends of Jesus, as believers, to announce the good news, to announce the gospel.
Leo XIV, who was born Robert Prevost, addressed the cardinals who elected him. Dressed in white and gold vestments, he spoke in the Sistine Chapel beneath Michelangelo's fresco, The Last Judgment. Leo was named just yesterday. Tens of thousands of people packed into St. Peter's Square to greet the new pontiff as he emerged onto the balcony of the Basilica. NPR senior producer Sarah Ventry and international correspondent Ruth Sherlock were there and take us through the surprising and historic day.
In the moments before the white smoke came, there were prayers in St. Peter's Square. Prayers in all languages, from priests, monks, nuns, and other faithful, like these women from Bangladesh. All with their own private hopes for who should become the new leader of the Catholic Church. And then, just after 6 p.m. in Italy, there it was.
The bells of St. Peter's Square are tolling. White smoke is billowing out of the chimney of the Sistine Chapel. It means a new pope, a new era for the Catholic Church.
In the crowd, there's so much anticipation and celebration. The Vatican Swiss Guards in their helmets with red plumes parade through St. Peter's Square. People cry, long live the Pope.
Everyone has come out to witness this moment in history. And here we go. The announcement is about to be made.
Habemus Papam. We have a Pope.
Cardinalem Prévost.
There's surprise at first, and a little confusion. People scramble on their phones to understand who this is. But there's no internet, almost no phone data, one woman says. Gradually the name Robert Prévost is passed through the crowd. Leo XIV, the United States of America's first Pope. Peace be with you all, are his opening words.
Fratelli, sorelle carissimi.
His speech carries echoes of the papacy of his predecessor Francis's focus on a global church. He wishes peace to, quote, all of the people all over the earth.
A tutti i popoli, a tutta la terra, la pace sia con voi.
I'm so proud of our church. I'm so proud of the Midwest. I'm so proud of all of our priests and deacons and bishops and cardinals that serve the church in the U.S. So very, very happy.
Kimberly Mandelko is from Minneapolis. She's interrupted by an Italian passerby.
Bad news on American Pope. Very bad news. After Trump, on American Pope.
He walks away before we can get his name, but he's worried about having an American Pope in the era of President Trump, viewed by some as a disruptor. But maybe this is why the world needs an American Pope, Mandelko says.
But maybe that's a good thing. American Pope with Trump. I think because he knows our system, being an American, he knows democracy. I think he knows how to talk to President Trump and to hopefully get him to back down.
Just one of the countless expectations, thoughts, and hopes from Catholics all around the world as they wait to learn more about their new Pope. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
During his initial remarks yesterday, the new Pope made special mention of Chiclayo, a city where he served in Peru. So we called somebody there. Janina Sessa is the former director of a Catholic charity in Chiclayo.
We saw a bishop who put on a helmet, boots, and went out to meet people. Very close, very, very humble with everyone, from those who held important positions to the most humble of people.
He needed the helmet and boots when responding to disasters such as flooding. He also tried to help people during a dengue fever outbreak and the pandemic.
During the pandemic, there was an oxygen shortage in Chiclayo. Thanks to his efforts, we were able to buy not one but two oxygen plants. That saved many lives. The oxygen was made available free of charge to anyone who needed it, especially the most vulnerable.
Cesa says the community that he once led in Peru will continue to try to give the Pope a little oxygen.
Now he can count on our prayers because it will also be a difficult road ahead for him.
Well, let's talk about that road ahead with another person from Robert Prévost's past, Reverend William Lego of St. Turibius Parish in Chicago, who has known the Pope since sixth grade. They attended high school together, went to seminary and to Villanova University together, and even after that were together for a time. Reverend Lego, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You must have known him before he ever said, I want to be a priest. What was he like then?
Well, I remember we met in sixth grade. It was a process where at the time religious orders and stuff would invite young men to their seminaries. It was a whole different system than we have today. And so we were together for a summer. So we did stuff like we did sports, we studied, they talked about the priesthood. So it was like a big basic introduction. And then when we got to high school, I know a lot of us, it was a very good education for a very good price at the time. Mm-hmm. And our parents were in favor of that. But also, all of us came from families that were very, what to call it, religious or very much united with their faith and practiced their faith. You know, so he was a normal kid. I mean, he was always studious. He was very intelligent. He always was one of the ones who kept us kind of focused on sometimes bigger issues and things. I hope that I'm making myself clear on that.
I think you're saying that he had the big strategic thoughts, whereas other people maybe were
at times. Yeah, at times. And he was also centered on helping people. He was always doing stuff for, you know, always very serviceable, as they say, very willing to do things.
Now, I want people to know, you told me a few minutes ago that you were with him in the novitiate, if I'm saying that correctly, a period of about a year where in your order you're told to think about this. Do you really want to spend your life doing this? Do you recall what pushed him in the direction that he ultimately went?
You know, a little bit. I mean, we were in Immaculate Conception, St. Henry Parish in St. Louis University, which is in one of the poorer parts of St. Louis. Our order had a parish there. So during that time, not only did we reflect on, is God calling us to continue this journey to become Augustinians and Augustinian priests later on, but also being in that parish, we had the opportunity to live with and work with the poor. And I think that honed for him his calling, for lack of a better term, on if we continue, it's going to be working with the poor. It's going to be working with those who need help or who need accompaniment, as they say.
So I'm thinking about a pope from Chicago, a pope from Villanova, a pope who lived in St. Louis among the poor. How do you reflect on the idea of an American as pope?
Well, if we're part of a universal church, which we are, my always thought is that, well, why not? If the church is open to the Spirit will look for, at the time, probably the best or candidate to lead the church. And our role as Catholics throughout the world is, once that expression of the Spirit becomes public, like it did yesterday for naming Cardinal Prevost as Pope, well, then our next journey is we begin to work together and continue to discover how the Spirit is alive in the world. And that goes in very much with the Augustinian, as I understand it. We call people into communion. We call people into community. We help them live and identify and put into practice their faith in ways that help them feel whole, help them live the gospel message in their lives.
Let me ask, though, Silvia Poggioli, our great correspondent in Rome, said that for the longest time it was considered taboo to have an American because America was already so powerful in so many other ways. Robert Barron, who is a bishop from Minnesota, spoke to CBS News before the announcement. And he said, he quoted a cardinal who once said that until America goes into political decline, there won't be an American pope because America is too powerful. Do you think the church is saying something by choosing an American?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know, you know, that's a very interesting statement that the bishop had made. And I would like to not necessarily discuss with him, but say, well, what does he mean by political decline? What does it mean that the view of the United States as somebody, as a country that's dominant in power, well, maybe that's an interesting insight. And how is it going to work out that now with an American pope, maybe that position, if he, from his point of view, power could be used for benefit of all. You know, there's always two sides to a coin.
We just have a few seconds here, but I'm reflecting. We have a very powerful president of the United States at the moment who is working to remake many parts of society. And now there's this other American who can't be fired, can't easily be intimidated, can't easily be defunded.
Well, it's going to be an interesting relationship, I think, as would be with any political leader with the church. I mean, that's always a very interesting dynamic to look at and to reflect on and to see how that's going to play out.
Last thing, when you talk with him next time, you're going to call him Robert, Leo, or something else?
Probably because of the fact that for out of respect of the office that he holds, I'll call him Leo.
Excellent. Excellent. Reverend William Lego, thanks very much for your insights. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for having me.
He's known Pope Leo XIV since sixth grade. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, R. Crumb, the king of underground comics, a famous eccentric, and a musician caught up in the blues and jazz of the past. Crumb created Zap Comics, and characters like Mr. Natural and Fritz the Cat. He's the subject of a new biography. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them. Offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Today, Russia marked the 80th anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Yet another war, the war in Ukraine, served as a backdrop to the event. Joining us to talk about it is NPR's Charles Maynes. He was on Red Square this morning, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Morning.
So, Charles, let's start with the parade. What caught your eye this year?
Well, you know, if last year was a fairly stripped down affair, for example, there was just one tank, today was just bigger in every way, not just the hardware, but also the guest list. That included China's Xi Jinping, who was billed as the guest of honor, and it really, the whole thing was designed to showcase Russia's military might. You know, of course, there were plenty of tanks. You can hear them rumbling a bit here. But it was also hard not to notice these massive nuclear missile launchers, which the Kremlin has used as not so subtle pushback against Western military support to Ukraine, or trucks loaded with aerial drones. These are weapons that have come to define the war in Ukraine for both sides and were making their debut in the parade. But of course, there was also the more familiar Soviet-style aspects to the event, the marching band, the goose-stepping soldiers, more than 11,000 of them, including 100 Chinese soldiers, marching along the Russians, quite a sight, as well as a speech by Russian leader Vladimir Putin, who, after all, has presided over this ceremony for the better part of a quarter century.
What did Putin say?
You know, it might be odd to say this was surprising, but Putin really focused his remarks on history and the idea of preserving the memory of the more than 20 million Soviets who gave their lives in the war. So here Putin says these Soviets bequeathed us to defend the motherland, to stay united and firmly defend Russia's national interests, its thousand-year history of culture and traditional values, everything that steered us, everything that's sacred. Now, he did pay tribute to China's role against Imperial Japan, perhaps a sign of Beijing's importance to Moscow these days, and, of course, Xi's presence. He also said Russia was grateful for the contributions of Western allies towards the victory in World War II. You know, what he didn't do was condemn the West or draw these false parallels between World War II and Russia's current war in Ukraine as one continuous battle against fascism, you know, something he's done repeatedly since he ordered the invasion of Ukraine more than 3 years ago.
That's really interesting. What explains the softer tone?
Well, you know, we can only guess. It might reflect these ongoing negotiations with the Trump administration that are towards not only ending the war, but resuscitating U.S.-Russian relations. It's also perhaps because the visuals, you know, the military hardware, the presence of soldiers currently fighting in Ukraine in the stands and marching on the square, you know, that all supplied the narrative on its own. Mm. You know, it's not hard to make the connection that they had victory then and they want victory now.
As we've already mentioned, it was also well attended by foreign dignitaries, including China.
Yeah, you know, the presence of dignitaries, nearly 30 foreign leaders, including, of course, Xi Jinping, that further amped the stakes for Russia as hosts. You know, making them comfortable meant making the rest of the city miserable. Traffic's been terrible because the police set up roadblocks. But again, this was all in the service of today's event, which I must say went off without a hitch, or it seemed to me.
That's NPR's Charles Maynes in Moscow. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy says he has a plan to overhaul the country's air traffic control system. He cited recent incidents as motivation. First was the mid-air collision near Washington that killed 67 people. Then there was the outage at Newark Airport that left air traffic controllers unable to communicate. NPR's Scott Newman reports.
Secretary Duffy was joined by lawmakers, the heads of the FAA, the National Transportation Safety Board, and the CEOs of major airlines as he made the announcement. He was even joined by President Trump on the phone.
All right, Mr. President, you're on speakerphone.
Hello, everybody. It's a great honor. Great honor.
The administration's plan calls for a top-to-bottom rebuild, new radar and communication systems, upgraded flight management technology, and the replacement of aging towers and support facilities. Duffy displayed decades-old hardware he says is still in use by air traffic controllers. He compared the current system to a flip phone in an age of app-driven smartphones. Stephen Creamer is president and CEO of the Air Traffic Control Association, an industry group that has pushed for upgrading airport systems. He says there's a lot to like about the proposal.
First thing that I like is the level of commitment that's been expressed by the Secretary of Transportation, by the administration. I mean, obviously, we heard the president.
Creamer says he's also encouraged by the level of bipartisan support in the House and Senate and commitment from industry leaders.
I think all of that is what is truly historic about today. The idea that the United States government is going to invest substantially.
Stephen Jacobson is a professor at the University of Illinois who studies aviation risk.
The recognition that the existing system needs to be not just upgraded, but needs to be transformed, I think, is critical.
But Jacobson thinks the proposal isn't far-reaching enough. For example, there's been no mention of using artificial intelligence, which could take over such mundane tasks as getting planes away from the gate, something that now requires a controller. He also thinks the administration's announced timeline, 3 to 4 years if the project is fully funded, is wildly optimistic. And notably absent from yesterday's rollout, any price tag for the sweeping plan.
But I have my concerns as well, because this is a pep rally right now, and everybody has the enthusiasm until it comes to Congress and goes into committee, and they have to find the $10, $15, $20 billion that this is going to cost.
And at a time when the administration is all about cutting costs, getting the money needed for such upgrades could still prove a challenge. Scott Newman, NPR News.
This afternoon, and all things considered, the president wants tariffs on foreign-made movies. Could that help a Hollywood comeback? Listen tax-free on the NPR app, on the radio, or on your smart speaker. Ask for your local station, which is in your community, by name. This is NPR News.
As Swedish author Fredrik Bachman was writing his latest book, he was seriously considering retiring. The demands of promoting his work were taking too much out of him.
Maybe I should go and see if there's something else that I could do that would make me a happier and a little more balanced individual.
I'm Ari Shapiro, Fredrik Bachman on Feeling Like a Fraud Despite His Success on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Retired Supreme Court Justice David Souter has died. He's being remembered as a low-key private figure whose impact on the nation's highest court was as a moderate justice who bucked expectations. Souter was a Republican nominee in 1990, but he surprised conservatives when he sided with his liberal colleagues on high-profile cases during his 19-year tenure. Souter was only 69 when he retired, but he eschewed Washington, D.C. life for his native New Hampshire. And according to a statement from the court, that's where he died yesterday at home. Former Justice David Souter was 85 years old. The new pope has not only made history as the first from the U.S. to be elected to lead the world's 1.4 billion Catholics, he appears to have Creole roots in Louisiana. A New Orleans genealogist and the pontiff's older brother, John Prevost, are cited in multiple news reports about the pope's ancestry. However, according to the New York Times, the pope's brother says the family did not identify as black. In the Sistine Chapel today, Pope Leo XIV celebrated his first Mass since his election yesterday.
Deus, qui regnum Christi, ubique terrarum dilatari.
Speaking in Italian, the Pope spoke of a lack of faith, often accompanied by, as he put it, appalling violations of human dignity, neglect of mercy, and other wounds that afflict society. This is NPR. The U.S. Postal Service's Board of Governors has announced a new Postmaster General as uncertainty surrounds the agency's fate under President Trump. David Steiner has served on the board of FedEx, a USPS rival. He succeeds Louis DeJoy, who stepped down in March as the USPS continued to carry out a decade-long reorganization plan he established in 2021. Advocates for the disabled and their paid caregivers held a pro-Medicaid rally yesterday in Washington. The demonstration was held as House Republicans consider Medicaid cuts to pay for President Trump's domestic agenda. Here's NPR's Joseph Shapiro.
At the base of the U.S. Capitol, the protesters staged the 24-hour vigil. They told their personal stories about how Medicaid pays for long-term care for their older parents and disabled children. Elena Hung runs a group called Little Lobbyists. She defended the insurance program for 72 million poor and disabled adults and children.
It is the reason why children like mine, children with complex medical needs and disabilities, are able to live at home instead of an institution or a hospital or facility or whatever you want to call it that's not home.
Some Republican lawmakers are balking at the prospect of slashing Medicaid to pay for the president's tax and spending cuts. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
The Dow is down more than 100 points. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. I was listening to the radio yesterday afternoon, NPR, of course, when our colleague Scott Detrow and the rest of the team had the news live that Robert Francis Prevost, an American from Chicago, was the next pope of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose was part of that coverage and has been looking into the life of the pope from Chicago. Hi there, Jason.
Hello.
What do you know about Leo?
Well, Pope Leo is 69 years old, which makes him a bit on the younger side for popes. He was an undergraduate at Villanova University in Pennsylvania, where he majored in mathematics. Like Pope Francis, he's a member of a religious order. In Prevost's case, the Augustinians, who focus on missionary work and education. Prevost, now Pope Leo, went to seminary at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, and he did his doctorate here in Rome. He spent significant parts of his ministry in Peru. During his greeting from the balcony overlooking St. Peter's Square yesterday, though, he spoke in both Italian and Spanish, but did not significantly, I think, speak in English. And he's served on the Pontifical Commission on Latin America, a place he knows well, given his time in Peru.
What sense do you have at this early moment about what style of pope he might be?
Well, here's what Cardinal Prevost told the Vatican's official news agency prior to his election as pope about what he thinks church leadership should be.
The bishop is not supposed to be a little prince sitting in his kingdom, but rather called authentically to be humble, to be close to the people he serves, to walk with them, to suffer with them, and to look for ways that he can better live the gospel message in the midst of his people.
And Steve, that's very similar to what Pope Francis was fond of saying, that a pastor who's a shepherd should smell like his sheep.
I've noticed that already there are some criticisms of Pope Leo.
That's right. Survivors of clergy sexual abuse say Cardinal Prevost did not do enough to address the issue as a bishop or archbishop or cardinal. But Steve, that's true of many in church leadership. Now the question is how he'll respond to victims going forward and how he handles abusive priests and those who covered up for them. He's also come under criticism for comments on LGBTQ people. Back in 2012, he lamented what he called the culture's sympathy with, quote, the homosexual lifestyle. And he spoke out against a government plan in Peru to teach about gender in public schools. He called promotion of, quote, gender ideology confusing and said such thinking creates genders that don't exist.
I noticed that there are some hardcore supporters of President Trump who seem to assume that he is going to be opposed to President Trump. They're applying that blue-red filter of the United States onto the pontiff. What are his politics to the extent that they're known?
Well, I think that he was a close ally with Pope Francis and as such will probably be willing to stand up to the Trump administration in the same way that the Vatican has for the last dozen years, talking out against the treatment of migrants, talking out against the treatment of people in Gaza and the way the war is being conducted there. So could be somebody who's willing to go head to head and a very prominent American figure willing to go head to head with another prominent American figure, the American president.
Absolutely. Isn't it surprising that it would be an American pope?
Well, I think it's stunning. Prevost's name had come up, of course, because of his position there in the Vatican. He's considered well qualified given his pastoral and administrative experience, but the U.S. is not the center of the Catholic world, and Vatican watchers said the U.S. has enough global power already. And the church, you know, Steve, is far more vibrant in other places, places where it's growing, like in Latin America and Africa and Asia. You know, Pope Francis, in fact, dramatically diversified the College of Cardinals during his papacy to reflect that. So many more cardinals from other parts of the world, but ones who chose an American. It is important to note that while Pope Leo is from the United States, he spent much of his life and ministry outside of the U.S., in Peru and at the Vatican. So he does bring a truly global perspective to the job.
Jason, thanks for your perspective.
You're welcome.
That's NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose.
Many Illinois Catholics are rejoicing at the election of the Pope from Chicago. Member station WBEZ's Anna Sevchenka has more.
Megan Resnicek is a Catholic formation teacher at Everest Academy, a pre-K school in a southwest suburb of Chicago. She was on a field trip with her sixth graders to Chicago's Holy Name Cathedral when they learned that Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost was elected Pope.
While we were inside getting a tour, we heard that the new Pope had been elected. So we quickly turned on the news and yeah, we're so excited to be here. This is amazing, especially because our new Pope is from Chicago.
How did your students react?
It was just instant excitement, just smiles on everyone's faces. I don't think anyone has stopped smiling for the past like hour since we found out.
That included her student, Max Schultz. He was experiencing the election of a pope for the first time.
I'm just happy that Pope Leo is to be our pope.
If there's something that you could tell him, what would you say?
I would just say that if it would be better if we all unite together and just hope the best for everyone.
Max's mom, Eva Schultz, also tagged along on the field trip. She said she was overjoyed when she learned the new Pope was from the United States, let alone the Chicago area.
Especially because it's Chicago, our hometown, so that makes it even more exciting.
Bishop Lawrence Sullivan, the Vicar General for the Archdiocese of Chicago, dropped by the cathedral after hearing the news of Pope Leo's election. He said he's proud that the first American Pope hails from the Chicago area. But Sullivan also thinks the Pope's nationality doesn't define him.
The people of God are not confined to national boundaries. He is not an American at this point. He's a child of God. And that's the way that he's going to lead, taking all people into consideration.
Although Pope Leo was born in the Chicago area, he's done most of his ministry overseas, like in Peru, where he was a missionary, parish priest, teacher, and bishop, and the Vatican, where he ran the office that selects and manages bishops across the globe. Sullivan says this shows that Pope Leo's ministry will transcend all borders. Father Gregory Sakowitz, the rector of the Holy Name Cathedral, agrees.
Pope Leo XIV, I'm going to say this, I think he's going to be very strong on the immigrant, human rights, and the earth, the care for the earth.
But many Catholics, like Rozenczyk, are also hoping the new Pope unites the Church at a time of increased political polarization.
You know, it's so easy to be divided in this day and age, to say I want him to be progressive or I want him to be conservative. I don't believe in politicizing the Church, though. I hope he brings unity to the Church is probably the biggest thing.
Eva Schultz says she's looking to see more inclusivity.
I'm looking forward to perhaps a little bit more drive towards uniting the youth, bringing youth back to the Catholic Church, including the youth, just like Pope John Paul II did. I feel like he united us, and this is what we need.
As we spoke, the kids beside us started to chant, "Long live the Pope." For NPR News, I'm Anna Savchenko in Chicago.
This is NPR News.
A new podcast explores how soap operas help tell the story of American life, from sexual assault and abortion to AIDS, next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. Animals in the wild usually help out their relatives first, even for social animals that live in groups. But scientists studying flocks of superb starlings over 20 years noticed something different. The songbird often helps unrelated starlings raise their chicks, get extra food, scare off predators. Some parents get help from up to 16 other birds. Maybe it's true for starlings too. It takes a village to raise a child. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Of all the tariffs the United States has imposed on products from around the world, the highest are for products made in China, which has forced companies to ask themselves what really counts as made in China. Jeff Guo from NPR's Planet Money podcast says this is a simple question without a simple answer.
Imagine you're a company making sticky notes. You buy paper, which comes from either Japan or Indonesia. You buy glue, which comes from Taiwan. And then in China, workers cut up the paper, apply the glue, and you've got yourself some sticky notes. Now, here is the million-dollar question these days. What is the country of origin of these sticky notes? Like, what is the official country they come from?
So U.S. law is very unique in its approach to country of origin.
Maureen Thorson is an international trade lawyer. She says companies are often surprised when she explains just how it all works.
You can have products, including fairly sophisticated products, where most of the components and the assembly is all happening in China, but the product is not deemed Chinese under U.S. laws.
U.S. law says that a product's country of origin is based on the place where its parts or ingredients were transformed into something new. The term for this is a substantial transformation. For example, if a company takes avocados from Mexico, brings them to China, and then turns them into guacamole, that is a substantial transformation. Customs would say that company's guacamole is a product of China. But not every example is quite so simple. Over the years, questions about country of origin have gotten pretty confusing.
The complexity of supply chains has grown over time, and that's really what drives the difficulties.
Larry Friedman is a longtime trade lawyer. He co-wrote the textbook on customs law. He says that as manufacturing has gotten more complicated, courts and customs officials have been raising the bar on what counts as a substantial transformation.
Basically, the rule now is that simple assembly, as opposed to more complex assembly, is often not enough to result in a substantial transformation.
That brings us back to our sticky note example, which, by the way, is a real case that Customs looked at several years ago. And what Customs decided was that the final step of the manufacturing process, where the paper and the glue were combined in China, that was not a substantial transformation. So those sticky notes would not count as products of China.
I think they were persuaded by the fact that, what do you use a sticky note for? To write on, like paper, because it's made of paper. So it's the paper that is important here. The stickiness is a bell and whistle to the sticky note, not the essence of the sticky note.
The essence of a product is what tends to matter these days. Here, Customs decided that a sticky note is basically paper. So its country of origin is where that paper was made. In this case, Japan or Indonesia. Recently, Maureen has been helping companies think about changing their manufacturing, so their products are no longer considered made in China. And sometimes, you don't have to move everything out of China, as long as another country is supplying the key component, the essence of the product, whatever that means. Jeff Guo, NPR News.
To learn more about what the labels Made in China and Made in USA mean, listen to the latest episode of Planet Money.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Joy Harjo is an internationally celebrated poet of the Muscogee Nation, and it is with words that she processes this life, joy, hardships, and in a new book, grief. It's called Washing My Mother's Body, A Ceremony for Grief, and it is dedicated to her late mother. When I spoke with Harjo, the 23rd U.S. Poet Laureate, about this work, she started by reading the first lines of her poem.
I never got to wash my mother's body when she died. I return to take care of her in memory. That's how I make peace when things are left undone. I go back and open the door. I step in to make my ritual, to do what should have been done, what needs to be fixed, so that my spirit can move on.
Joy, this poem, Washing My Mother's Body, and these first few lines, how did they come to the page for you?
That's always a mystery. That's a mystery with anything, you know? Where does it come from and how does it get there? And I was in the middle of writing something totally, you know, on my father's family and removal from the Southeast and history. And this poem just interrupted and elbowed its way through. And there I was writing about wanting to wash my mother's body, but not allowed the opportunity. And the poem showed me, well, if you couldn't do it in person, you can go back and wash her body in a poem.
Can you describe the importance of that ritual to wash your mother's body before she was laid to rest?
Yeah, it's about acknowledging the story that her spirit inhabited in her body. And it's a way of helping us as well as her to let go. I say, we're here, we walked part of this story with you, and we love you, and we wish you the best on the next part of your journey.
We have something very similar in our tradition. I'm Muslim, and we have something called Ghusl Mayyit, the washing of the dead, where you, for purification and respect and dignity and to help with the passing, you wash the body. Going back in time to do the thing that you wanted to do in that moment for your mom, what was that like?
It's interesting how that poem just took over. It was like I was there almost as a witness. I was observing the ritual as it was happening.
Did it give you a closure or something that you needed that you didn't have?
I think it did, and I didn't realize how much I needed that until I had written the poem. It's interesting. We all have, I think, the child's view, especially the daughter's view of the mother, is so potent. And we probably know them more than anyone in some way. But she was beautiful. She was outgoing. She loved to dance. People always came to her for advice. And she had a great compassion. She would look after people. She was a songwriter, but that part of her life was eclipsed when she had four children, one right after the other. And then after the fourth one was involved in a divorce and became involved with someone very difficult, but she was so lively and had so much energy and so outgoing.
I know that you lost a daughter recently and you did get to wash her body. Going through that as a mother, what was that like?
That was something that was so profound, and I'm writing about it, but there are no words invented yet for losing a child. You know, I think it's important that we are present, that we do not hand over our time and our rituals. It's important to take time to honor in our own ways the lives of those we've lost. And so to be able to stand in a circle around my beloved girl and to do this ritual of washing her body together was profound. And it gave a sense of ritual that there we were together honoring this incredible, brilliant, creative life and acknowledging the gift of her.
And you were able to do for her what you weren't able to do for your mother.
Yes, something I never would have imagined.
Your poem is about the complexity of grief, the relationship of a mother and daughter. the story of your mom. What do you hope readers get from it this Mother's Day and every day?
I guess just to realize that to lose a mother, to lose a daughter, is difficult. And the thing I've been learning with grief is that it's always there. It takes different forms. You may think you've gotten over a hump of it, and then it surprises you.
You said that daughters know their mothers in a different way. What do you mean?
There's something about daughters, a daughter coming from a mother. There's something about that matrilineal link that is so potent. And I remember being there when my first granddaughter was born. There was just something in that whole potent connection that it goes beyond words.
When you finished this poem, you said you kind of got lost in it. Did you come out of it different?
I think so. I was different in the way of understanding how poetry is a tool, not just for poets and readers, but for all of us. So I've encouraged, when I've read it, encouraged people that maybe there's someone that you can't speak to, or, you know, here's Mother's Day. And sometimes our relationships with our mothers and our daughters and granddaughters are so complex. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's good just to sit down and write. It doesn't have to be a poem, you know, write a letter or a story or something. And what I have found in the act of creation, whether it's writing poetry or stories or music, that I open up and I learn things. And sometimes in that process, you come to a greater compassion. You can come to a greater understanding.
Joy Harjo is a poet. She was the 23rd U.S. Poet Laureate. Her new book is Washing My Mother's Body. Thank you so much, Joy.
Thank you, Layla.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.